And welcome back, listeners. It is the day that you've all been waiting for. Season 3 of Riddles in the Dark kicks off, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute. And I am your co-host, Dave Kale. And with me, as always, is the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, and Trish Lambert. And I'm not going to beat around the bush. Let's get right to it, because we know you've all been dying to hear what we thought about the movie.
That's
so
right.
Good morning, you two.
Good morning. So,
good morning.
First, we're going to start off by kind of explaining, you know, since this is the first episode of season 3, and we are working towards the grand climax of the Riddles in the Dark saga, we've decided to make a few changes this year. One of our themes, as you will have no doubt detected, and certainly the differences, I am sure, going to shine through episode by episode for the entire year, is increased organization on our part. So one of the things we're changing up the way that we do our riddle game a little bit this year. And our goal here is to separate more the period of the year in which we are just, you know, talking about, you know, doing analysis in advance, you know, doing analysis and speculation, and then the time of the year when we shift towards really doing analysis of what we've been seeing. Because increasingly, last year, you know, this happened a little bit in the first year, and it was a little bit more pronounced for me in the second year, getting sort of uncomfortable and mixing those things when we're still asking riddles, but riddles are being answered or half answered in trailers, and just having the whole thing kind of not be consistent in that way. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to have, you know, right around the time the first real trailer comes out is when we're going to actually close our official riddle competition. So we're going to have, you know, a bunch of riddle episodes leading up to that point. And then we'll still have the stuff posted so for people who discover us late, they can still fill out a ballot and stuff. But as far as official entries into our riddle game competition, will have to be submitted by the end of that period. And right now we're looking at, August, the end of August or September. Right in there is the area that we're thinking of for the official end of the riddle contest in that way, to sort of...
Last episode is scheduled right now to be the Friday before Labor Day weekend.
Okay,
which is
right.
The very first,
right.
Yeah,
right.
So then the deadline for submitting would be somewhere like a week to 10 days after that.
Yes, that's right. So you're looking at like the first half, middle of September, basically, is when the official riddle contest will continue. And then, of course, we will, you know, we'll be continuing to have episodes, we'll continue to do stuff. But that's when we'll be focusing on discussing the trailers, discussing the extended edition of the Desolation of Smaug when it comes out, discussing the soundtrack and all of the other stuff, the video logs and the other things that are released, as we then, you know, shift from simple book discussion and speculation and analysis to looking at what they're actually showing us and seeing what evidence we have of what they're actually doing. So
now Brianna makes a point, and I want to answer this because we do have an answer for it. She says, unless they have a teaser trailer in early summer. Well, sure, and Jackson's going to have vlogs come out, you know, before that. But here's the deal. We're not going to talk about those in Riddles in the Dark until after the game is over, number one. Number two is... even the co-hosts get to change their answers before the deadline.
That's right. That's right. So that everyone will have the chance to submit their final answers. So it's true, Brianna. There was the teaser trailer that was released in June last year. But as I if my memory serves me correctly, we got very few definitive answers to riddles in that teaser
right.
trailer. By the time we got the second and third trailers, much more was being revealed, and there were some pretty definitive answers to at least one or two riddles at that point. But the teaser trailer, I don't think so much. So anyway, we're going to kind of take that stuff into account. But yeah, we'll do a more detailed analysis of that stuff when we get to the analysis portion.
So wait, when the teaser trailer comes out, we're not going to do a four-hour frame-by-frame analysis of it?
No, we'll wait until after the game's over to do that.
Yeah.
Those are like people's favorite episodes, though.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see, you know, if...
we can always do a special.
Yeah,
I suppose,
we can always do an extra one.
Yeah.
We just don't want to lose our actual analysis episodes, too.
Right.
But
we want to stay on schedule.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's right.
Discipline. That is the philosophy. That's right. Rigor and discipline. That's totally what we're about here.
See, I gotta say, I mean, you guys could be creating a monster here, because you know, Corey, I mean, you asked me in the year one if I would be the project manager for Riddles in the Dark, but I kind of matched my style to you and Dave.
so you just didn't manage.
Yeah, well, I kind of did, but I didn't really, like, press too hard, you know? But now you're, like, saying this, and I'm like, okay, I'm taking this as carte blanche.
Oh, God. What have we done?
Exactly. Kate Neville says, we shall all burn together.
I am death.
Don't worry, we already regret it.
No, it's good. It's good. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to be organized.
Corey knows how to get me to stop that. He just sends me a sarcastic email.
Yeah. So anyway, okay. So I just to let you know. So and of course we're going to start the year. Today's episode and the second episode, we're going to have two that are really focused, looking backwards on the Desolation of Smaug. Today is going to be more kind of theoretical issues and general responses. In the second episode, we're going to be talking about some specific scenes and specific themes from the film, and then we'll segue into our episodes, which focus much more on the third film, and begin the riddles then as well. So that is the plan. All right. Well, with that in mind, then I want to begin the theoretical discussion portion. The thing I want to start with is I want to address, because I feel like one of the things which for me has been most fascinating about this whole season of response to the Desolation of Smaug is that I kind of realized a couple days ago, you know, I've been talking about the film, I keep talking about the film, I keep engaging in, like, you know, Twitter fights with people about the film, and I realized, you know, it's actually been weeks since I've thought about the movie itself. The film itself has not been the topic of discussion for me at all. That's not been the main issue. For me, what this season has been about more than anything else has been really working through these theoretical issues. I have found this all really profitable, because this whole situation, brought up by the Hobbit films in general, but really by the Desolation of Smaug in particular, has really drawn my attention to a bunch of theoretical questions that I think I had never really thought through thoroughly enough. And that's one of the reasons why I approached, you know, if you guys have listened to my reactions episode that I released on the Tolkien Professor feed, the reason I approached that the way that I did and started off with those sort of much more theoretical questions and approaches is basically because that's really where my focus has been. So one thing I wanted to address at first is there have been several people who have been expressing some irritation at me one way or another for constantly defending the films or attempting, in their words, to justify them. And, you know, thinking about that, you know, responding to that, I'm thinking, you know, really, I don't feel that way at all. I am not trying to defend this film. I'm certainly not trying to defend Peter Jackson. But it basically, it sort of caused me to step back for a second and say, why is it that the negative reactions, that the majority of the negative reactions that I have seen to the Desolation of Smaug annoy me so much? Because they do. It's easy to understand why people would think that I am, like, enormously defensive on behalf of these films. That's not how I really feel, but I can see how it would look like that, because I have in fact been having very great difficulty restraining myself from responding to people who are all negative about it. But the reason for that, as I've been thinking about it, the reason that I am so invested in this year is that I feel like the whole issue of not just of adaptation in general, but of analysis and interpretation is, like, what is being attacked. That is what I feel is being attacked. What has been getting my goat about the critics And I'm talking not about movie critics, because not only do I not really care what they say, I don't really know what they're saying because I don't pay a lick of attention to them. But as far as Tolkien fans are concerned, what has been really getting my goat about a lot of Tolkien fan responses to this film is that they're not thinking about the film. I see very little evidence of actual analysis of the film. And that tendency to kind of switch off and say, you know, I don't like this, I think this is bad, even and the only justifications that I hear are justifications which are not based, as far as I can see, they're not based on any actual analysis of the film. And that really bothers me. You know, I feel like, look, if you actually...
In some cases, it's not even based on viewing the film.
Right, exactly. It's not even based on viewing the film. It's like we have concept, and I don't need to hear anything else other than that there is like a, you know, an elf dwarf romance involved to know that this is a travesty of Tolkien's thought. Really? Right. Really? Anyway, so that's what's really bothering me. You know, when push comes to shove, there are several things I don't like about the films, and we'll talk about those. And we might wait until next time to talk about some of those specific things. But again, to me, that's not the issue. To me, the issue is: are you actually willing to sort of think this through? You know, one of the things that I that I've also been thinking about a lot is, again, I think back to my own purist past, back when I was, especially when I was in high school. And what changed for me, the thing that changed for me, what converted me from being a purist was primarily reading medieval literature. One of the things that I discovered in medieval literature is how much fun it is. The medievals loved, more than anything else in literature, what they loved was taking a story and taking a tradition and retelling it and redoing it and revisiting it. And looking at things like, of course, the most obvious and canonical example of this is the King Arthur story. You go and you look at all of the different King Arthur versions. And these are not just like independent versions. You know, these are versions that are deliberately translating and adapting and working with each other. And you can have completely, wildly different versions of the Arthurian story told by two authors in a very similar place and time, but who are just very interested in very different things, and who are neither one of them showing more or less respect for the Arthurian tradition. That story is a story that was being retold not because people were being flippant or mercenary about it, but because they took it so seriously, because they loved it so much, and they thought it was so important. Basically, so that was sort of the thing that really kind of opened my eyes when I realized, you know, it's even more fun than sitting back with my arms folded and saying tut tut, you know, and tisk tisk when I look at these things and basically kind of in, you know, holding fast to my own previous ideas and the story and thing that I loved. I could still have that thing. I didn't have to leave the story that I loved. I could still have that. But what I could also get is the pleasure of comparing and contrasting, of looking and seeing, you know, putting these two things next to each other and saying, you know, where do the differences really lie? What kind of story is this person telling and through their telling of the King Arthur story? And what is Mallory really interested to compared to what Chrétien de Troyes really interested in? You know, how is, especially ones that are really close. And, you know, it's, I mean, I'm basically, I found that when I started to do that, when I started to actually do careful analysis and compare and contrast, that, like, I just found that was so much more fun than purism. That, like, that kind of thing, I just eat on toast. I love that stuff. And that is the pleasure that I get from the Jackson films. And I say pleasure even in moments that are annoying. Like, again, going back to some Lord of the Rings film stuff that drive me bananas on one level, yet I find them really fascinating to think about, and they do nothing but increase my appreciation of Tolkien and the process of and the process of discussing the similarities and differences and doing that analysis is really it's an enormous learning experience, and it's really fun. And I feel like that process is more than anything else what I'm wanting to defend. Like, and what is bothering me are the people who not only refuse themselves to engage in any kind of close analysis and really thoughtful comparison and contrast, but who are trying to shut it down. You know, who are trying to say, like, I don't want to hear anybody who says that these films are anything but a money grab. And I'm like, well, you know, no, I'm sorry. You can't say that, jerk. Like, I'm going to do that analysis, and that's okay. You know, and you're missing out. And the fact, if you want to miss out, you can miss out. But, you know, don't tell me it's not a legitimate thing to do. Yeah. So anyway, that's what's been really bothering me.
Yeah, I agree. Because I still remain kind of a purist about the Lord of the Rings films. I haven't tried to watch Two Towers recently, but in the past, even just a few years ago, I had trouble getting through all the way through the Two Towers.
Right.
I was watching. Teresa forced me to watch The Fellowship of the Ring a couple weeks ago, and I noticed a lot of things that used to really bother. Like, I don't watch it with the same knee jerk, oh god, that's terrible, oh god, they changed that, blah blah blah. I see myself going through the same process we've done with The Hobbit, looking and thinking, well, that's an interesting choice, I wonder why they do that and stuff.
I think
the thing that a lot of people are missing is that I guess for me, sort of, if I want to be a little bit crass about it, it's not that I actually like the movies necessarily. I kind of do have enjoyed the Hobbit films, but it really isn't a matter of me actually really liking the films. Like when sort of non-Tolkien people press me on them, I often find myself, I readily can dig up lots of criticisms, and it's clear there's parts of it that I don't think work very well. But
right.
But I, it's sort of a meta enjoyment, right? Like the thinking about the films, I just enjoy thinking about the films. Like they have putting them in relief against the books has helped me find new and deeper enjoyment of the books and other adaptations and just sort of the whole environment around the books. Like, the thing is, without the films, I don't know if we'd all be furiously discussing the books right now. So.
Right. Right.
So setting aside whether the books are any good or not, it certainly has added to my enjoyment of things. And,
right.
And I can tell you one thing I can tell you for sure, you know, for people out there who think, like, oh, you guys are just making excuses for the films and stuff. There is, let me tell you, I watched this, I went to the L.A. Tolkien Society's toast to Tolkien last week, and I went and watched this film with some of those folks. And there's a pretty strong, unsurprisingly, a huge overlap between the LA Tolkien Society and the staff of the OneRing.net.
Right, right.
There is a universe apart of us and what we do and what we say about the films and what some of those folks are doing. Those folks just literally, they just love the films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just think they're perfect. These are masterpieces. Like, every little thing I dug up about, well, I don't know about this, I don't know about that, even about the Lord of the Rings films, they had almost no criticism. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, the only criticisms they really had, I'm making them kind of caricatures. I'm sort of a little hyperbolic, so if any of them are listening, I apologize. I don't mean to offend you, but the main criticisms I heard is they just weren't, you know, they weren't Peter Jackson enough. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like, well, there's a difference between that level of like enjoyment, like, oh, they're just great. Like, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
I would say I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah. I mean,
but really,
exactly.
Really, what we really enjoy is doing this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, I really do admire the films. I think that they are really thoughtful. It's that thing, you know, it's that tendency of some people to like accuse me of just like mindlessly defending the films, and I'm like, no, what I'm trying to defend the films against is mindlessness, actually. Like, that's
right.
Kind of the
yes.
whole point, is that, you know,
mindless enjoyment or mindless criticism
and what I'm seeing is mostly mindless criticism
because mindless criticism is an attempt to ruin enjoyment of them for other people, which
yes.
sucks.
Yes. Yes. It does. And it's just, and again, it goes against everything, like all of the things that made me insufferably as a child, but effective as a teacher, are those things that just, like, cannot stand to hear people talk that way. Like, if to see people not thinking about something, to see people, you know, and to want to jump in and say, no, like, let's work through this together. Like, you know, the thing that you just said makes no sense. Don't you see that? You know, that's why, you know, my goat has been gotten so often in this whole Desolation of Smaug's thing, because I feel like this film has really pushed people into those camps. You know, that there's the mindless lovers and the mindless haters, and not that much in the middle. I mean, I don't want to, like, over glamorize what we're doing at Riddles,
like,
in the Dark.
Politics.
But I do feel like, you know, those, you know, the Riddles in the Dark people, and I mean all of you who are listening and who have been following, those of you who enjoy the kind of thing we've been doing, I feel like are the only group of people, you know, like, you are the kind of people who are in the middle, you know, who are doing neither one of those things. And that's...
Yeah, you attempt to take a balanced view, you're going to get criticized by both sides, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what's been happening. You know, it's been really... So that element of it has been really frustrating, but...
Well, let me try an angle out with you guys.
Trish, were you ever a purist?
I don't think so. I actually gave a paper last year on the evolution of The Hobbit. It was it was before the first movie came out. So it was like I had to speculate based on what we'd been doing in Riddles in the Dark to talk about the adaptation piece. But part of the evolution of The Hobbit wasn't just Tolkien's writing. The last part of my paper had to do with its adaptation to stage and film. And so I was kind of trying to set a tone for the upcoming first movie. And there's a letter, and unfortunately I don't have the number of the letter. Somebody out there probably can find it. It was written in 1958, and it was in response to a proposed film script for Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
And Tolkien went into a lot of detail about his feelings about adaptation. And, of course, I think at this point, too, judging what I've read, and Hammond and Skull actually has a nice in that their Tolkien, what's it called, the Companion? What's their two-volume thing called, Corey? I can't remember. The big reference. Reader's Guide and the Companion, I think it is, right?
The Hammond and Skull?
Hammond and Skull.
Yeah,
and it's their reader's guide. It's the Tolkien reader's guide. They have a section on adaptation, and they talk about history. And, in fact, my favorite story is that Humphrey Carpenter, who ended up being Tolkien's biography, did an egregious film stage adaptation of The Hobbit that poor Tolkien sat and watched. And he actually had Smaug being killed at the mountain. Can you imagine changing the script to that degree, and you've got the author in the audience?
Right.
Anyway, and he said because he felt it was better because it put that it more in the center of the action. I'm like, oh, you're kidding me. Oh, my God. Anyway, Tolkien wrote, he actually even, in the script for Lord of the Rings, he was saying that he understood that there's stuff that needed to be cut. But he said there's things that are part of the heart of the story and things that are not. And the example that I use, which I think would surprise folks, is that he said, for example, if you need to cut either the Ents or Helm's Deep, Battle of Helm's Deep, I would cut the Battle of Helm's Deep because it doesn't forward the story. You know, and to me, when I read that, it's like, well, he recognized, you know what I mean? I thought, how would he thought the fact that Jackson kept both of them in? And what he did to the Ents. But anyway, that's another story. So what he actually said in his letter, he wrote, the canons of narrative art in any medium cannot be wholly different. And the failure of poor films is often precisely in the exaggeration or in the intrusion of unwarranted matter, owing to not perceiving where the core of the original lies. So not perceiving where the core of the original lies. I think that the way to really approach these adaptations, and I think I'm moving myself up to actually doing this maybe as a paper at some point, is using that as the yardstick, both for Lord of the Rings and for The Hobbit. You know, now you can still debate that. People can still have disagreements as to whether Jackson stayed with the core of the original, you know, in both movies. But I think that's the valid conversation to have. Really.
Exactly. That makes sense as a standard of evaluation. It's not about what has been changed or how much has been changed. And again, this is why, that's also exactly why I am so resistant to people who want to have a knee jerk. And let me say, you know, from the top, totally understandable knee-jerk reaction to the Toriel and Keeley thing, is that my response to that, my objection to that, is when I look at it, I do find it consonant with the core. You know, where it goes is exactly not... It's exactly not filler. It's not extra to the story. And we'll talk about that. That's one of the things we'll talk about a little bit more next week. So we'll do some more detailed analysis and discussion of that. But exactly, you know, that's really the question. But you have to be willing to take some deep breaths, get past your initial reactions, right, get past the superficial things, and really think about what is the core story that the film is telling, what is the core story that the book is telling, and how do those two things compare? That to me, that is the standard. That's exactly...
I mean, imagine if there had been a film made while Tolkien was alive and the Battle of Helm's Deep had been left out.
Right.
What would the purists have said?
Right. Right. Well, and because the thing is that it's not just about purism in a purely snobbish form. Like, you know, I think that especially Tolkien purists are very different from, like, say, extreme wine tasting snobs, for instance. You know, it's not like that kind of purism. You know, it's not like someone who will look down their noses at you and say, "Oh, how could you possibly hold your wine glass that way, you ignoramus?" You know, it's not like that. It's instead. Sorry, I'm mentioning this because I just recently had a house guest who was doing kind of things like that in a less insufferable way, but it's made me think of it. Anyhow, the Tolkien purists, you think about the Battle of Helm's Deep. If he had cut the Battle of Helm's Deep, which is, of course, given Peter Jackson's own interests, inconceivable, but if he had cut the Battle of Helm's Deep, people would have objected to that, I think, not just for the, like, snobbish and dispassionate reason that it differs from Tolkien, but from the much more understandable and much more, to me, admirable affection for the story. That is, I know I grew up loving the Battle of Helm's Deep. If I had to list, you know, my favorite passages in The Lord of the Rings for most of my life, the Battle of Helm's Deep would have been in my top three. And so, therefore... it would have wounded me awfully to see a film adaptation that just callously tossed aside the Battle of Helm's Deep because I loved it so much. And that's what I see again and again from Tolkien fans who are responding to these films. They are responding, you know, when they're responding to details, it's not just, it's not simply a purism thing, but rather a, like, cut out, changed, messed with something that I have really great affection for.
You know, the other thing that I've mentioned actually too before is the extended edition of Unexpected Journey is very interesting, I think, to listen to, because Boyens does explain some of the decisions they made. And the interesting part was a lot of the stuff they explained were things we had actually brought up in Riddles in the Dark. Like, how did they decide that? Or, you know what I mean? It's like, it was almost as if they'd been listening and she was, like, explaining to us why they decided.
Right.
And again, you may not agree with Boyens, and it may be they maybe made the wrong decision, especially if you're using this yardstick of the Accord of the Original. But I think that people need to listen to that. If people are really going to, like, seriously engage with this topic, that's a must listen to. And I would imagine they're going to probably do the same with the director's commentary on the second extended edition too.
Yeah. It just, Noam Weiss says purists love too much the work of somebody else's hands.
That's true.
We sent Olmo after those guys.
Exactly. Yeah. Where's Tuor when you need him? No, it's, and again, I don't want to, you know, the last thing I want to do is just sound totally unsympathetic for somebody who feels like that. Again, I would have felt the same way about Helm's Deep. The last thing I am trying to convince anybody of is to have, you know, less affection for and less attachment to, you know, the stuff that are in the books, you know, the stuff that you love in the books. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But you have to realize that it's sort of a different thing. This reminds me of a sort of a broader issue. another criticism that I've seen a bunch of Tolkien people say. You know, in their reviews or assessments of the film, they will say with great gravity, this is not Tolkien's Hobbit. This is really just not Tolkien's Hobbit. And my response is, well, of course not! What did you expect? I mean, no, this is Peter Jackson's adaptation of Tolkien's Hobbit. You're not going to get Tolkien's Hobbit on film. And again, see, this is where, you know, Tricia comes back to what you were saying about the core, right? If you want to say that the core is different, well, I mean, I think you have to dig a little deeper to be able to say the core has shifted in various ways away from the core of the Hobbit. That I actually don't find to be true of the films. I find the core of the Hobbit films very much, at least, you know, not identical with the core of Tolkien's films, but or of Tolkien's books, but really dealing with them, really engaging with the same stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, to by point of contrast, the Rankin-Bass films, and it's really easy to bash on the Rankin-Bass films because they've aged in some really weird ways.
So, but it doesn't stay as true, don't you think?
The core of that film, although it is, you know, that film is in some ways exactly what everybody says they want and says they're disappointed they haven't gotten from the Peter Jackson films. That is to say, a film adaptation which really just does the book and doesn't try to bring in any of the Lord of the Rings perspective things, almost any. The Rankin-Bass just does the published book, mostly. But the core of that film, I mean, the things that they miss and where they end up putting the focus, especially the way that they do, and I understand, you know, in the times, it was the mid-70s, you're still in the immediate, you know, Vietnam War era. I can sympathize with all of that. But they put this really heavily anti-war message into the end of The Hobbit. You know, the Battle of Five Armies becomes a criticism of war entirely, and therefore, you know, in my mind, when I watch the end of the Rankin-Bass film, I feel like the themes of the book have been utterly eviscerated in the way that they've treated the story, and they have taken the core and they've shifted it into a completely different direction. So like the two things that annoy me most about the Rankin-Bass film are the ending and the stupid Glenn Yarborough theme song at the beginning. And if it were just
how dare you?
If it were just annoying, I could deal with it. But again, it's the thematics of it. It's annoying when you hear it. When you actually sit down and think it through, it becomes infuriating. Exactly, Scott. The greatest adventure song. That's precisely what I'm talking about. I feel like people who are expecting Tolkien's Hobbit are doubly fooling themselves. Like, I feel like the fact that expectation has been disappointed, that's not a Peter Jackson story. That's a story about the critic. You know, like, why on earth were you expecting that? Why is that even a question that you're asking yourself? First of all, again, it's an adaptation. Second of all, presenting Peter Jackson's The Hobbit, or projecting Tolkien's The Hobbit, you know, Peter Jackson projecting Tolkien's The Hobbit, the book, alone is never the project he undertook. You know, people keep wanting to declare the films a failure because they don't succeed in doing the thing they never even attempted to do. And that's another thing that again just kind of drives me around the bend sometimes about this stuff.
I just love hearing Corey get so weird.
Can you tell I've been bottling this up? You know, this is like me letting out all of those times I haven't responded to people on Twitter.
Did you see Erica Smith's comment? I think I'm more critical of Desolation of Smog because of engaging with the text through the whole last year of Riddles in the Dark.
Yeah.
See? We actually increased criticism of the film,
right.
People. How can we be apologists?
Yeah, sure. No, exactly. And Erica, I respect that. You know, and we can have respectful discussions about that. And there are many ways, you know, in which I am certainly willing to be convinced. If, you know, if people want to, you know, through the course of our analysis and through further analysis, people want to make arguments that my initial reading is my initial reading of The Desolation of Smaug, I've still only seen it twice. My initial reading of The Desolation of Smaug is that, you know, by and large, the core of it lines up pretty well with the core of The Hobbit, but I could be convinced otherwise.
Well, you know, you made a really good point, Corey, in your two-parter, which you maintained a much more level degree of emotion, and I want to acknowledge, than, you know, but I'm glad you saved it for Riddles in the Dark. I think that's appropriate. you made a really good point that I have been engaging myself with since I heard you say it, which is, you know, you went back even to the Lord of the Rings movies. There are even the parts we don't like, and, you know, I said to Corey earlier, it's hard to say, you know, people can't, like, function, they don't get it when you say, oh, I like these parts, I didn't like these parts. It's kind of like people want to be digital about these movies. But even the parts you didn't like Faramir, for example, in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
It gives you the opportunity to go back and say, why is it this bothers me?
Yes.
It allows you to go back to the books and do a deeper reading and a deeper analysis of Tolkien's writing because of your negative reaction to the film, to that part of the film. I really liked that. I mean, that almost makes it worth watching even if you hate the whole movie.
Yes.
Because it allows you to go back and really go, okay, this is why. This is why. Because, you know, the story that Tolkien wrote is XYZ, and, you know, this theme didn't get dealt with or whatever.
Exactly. Thinking carefully about the scenes, especially in the Lord of the Rings films, that I disliked most have been some of the things that have brought me most long-term profit from the Lord of the Rings films. In exactly that way. And certainly I have found, you know, and I would say doubly so as a teacher. And being able to have the films as both a point of contrast and a point of entry for students has made those even doubly, to me, profitable.
And if you think about it, like, I'm so glad your book came out before the movie came out, you know, because nobody can say that you wrote that book, you know, in any kind of collusion.
Right.
But, like, one of the points you make in your book is about how clueless the dwarves are.
Yes.
How totally clueless, Thorin and everybody is totally clueless. Can you imagine if Jackson had stayed true to that piece of the book in the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Which they kind of did in Rankin Bass, actually.
Yes. Yes, they do. They do. And it's Yeah. No, I agree. I think that, and even, you know, Trish, even thinking about what you were saying about, you know, binary responses, you know, people just sort of wanting to, you know, hate the whole movie or love the whole movie. You know, I think that can even happen within individual things that you like and dislike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you're willing to go further than, like again, to come back to the Faramir example. I really... You know, I mean, I'm certainly one of the people who finds Faramir one of the things that's hardest to get over in the Two Towers film. And yet, I can recognize the fact that, I feel like there are really two elements of Faramir's character that are kind of at play for me when I'm watching Peter Jackson's Faramir. One is the thing that I'm losing, which is the stature of Faramir and the way, the role that Faramir plays in the book. Faramir is like, welcome to Gondor. You know, he is like the vision of what Gondor means. When you meet Faramir and get to know Faramir, you know, you come to appreciate what the Numenoreans in Middle, what the Numenoreans mean to Middle Earth. You know, I mean, he helps us to get in touch with the high tradition. If we hadn't met Faramir already in book three, in book four, when we get to Minas Tirith in book five, I think the whole thing would have less impact. Because we've already gotten a window on the West in Faramir himself. That element got excised from Faramir in the film. However, the part of Faramir that he did play up, what that appeared primarily to be sacrificed for in the film, was the treatment of Faramir's relationship with his father and, to a lesser extent, with his older brother. And, you know, wanting to play up the Faramir as, you know, insecure younger son who is striving for the love of his father, whose favorite was his older brother. And the fact is, that's there in Tolkien too. And while at the same time I came to appreciate the role of Faramir in the book more for the things that were removed from it in the film, so too the things that Peter Jackson emphasized in Faramir's character, that is Faramir's daddy issues, actually prompted me to look more carefully at the way in which Faramir's daddy issues are in fact present in the book. And I do think that that's actually a very interesting and important element. And I come back, you know, one way that that impacted me, thinking carefully about Peter Jackson's Faramir enriched for me not just my reading of Faramir earlier on, but my reading of Faramir in the Houses of Healing in his conversation with Eowyn. Because thinking of Faramir only as like that bastion of high, lofty nobility that we see, and that's a really important part of him, and to see, you know, him coming alongside Eowyn in the conversation they have, but to see him looking at her and the level of compassion and pity he can have, on one level, what Tolkien gives us in Faramir and Eowyn are two people who have both experienced loss and both been in a similarly kind of, not exactly the same kind of trapped position, but that there's much more resonance. He is somebody who can really relate to, like, the brokenness of her life that has led her to the place where she is. And that element of Faramir, Peter Jackson really emphasized. Again, I feel like in the end, the cost was too high for that. In Peter Jackson's film, I'm still not defending Faramir. But again, you know, so even within that one particular element, you know, I found that if I try not to be too binary about it, it leads to more interesting stuff. Anyway.
Now, Kate Neville made a really good point a while back, and she said she really believes that it's not truly fair to judge the changes and choices that Jackson and company have made until we see the entire arc.
Yes.
She actually points out the other way, which is there are parts of the Fellowship that she didn't mind at first, but after seeing all three, then she found, you know, she went back and found those pieces disappointing. So that can move both ways.
Yes.
You could resolve some issues, but then again, you could also have some issues by seeing the arc. But I do agree. I mean, I think we'll have, you know, our conversation this time next year will be, I'm sure, looking at the entire three-story arc.
Yeah. I think that's fair. The one pushback I would give to that, living in La La Land out here and you know, having a wife working in the industry and all of her friends, is I imagine what some of them would say is there's sort of a growing annoyance amongst the creative types here at the idea that, like, you know, look, this film's all part of a trilogy, and you really can't judge it or say anything about it until you've seen all of them. There's a certain resistance to that notion from folks out here who are like, for God's sake, can't somebody just make a movie? Like, can't people just make a complete start to end? You don't need to go watch the extended edition. You don't need to watch four other movies, blah, blah, blah. And I do think that criticisms about individual films, you know, that are leveled at, like, look, I feel like this particular film didn't have a coherent story, blah, blah, blah. I think those are fair. Like,
yes.
At the end of the day, they should be making good individual films,
yes,
in addition to making a great adaptation and a great trilogy and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Agreed. I do definitely agree with that.
Or at least I understand that notion. There's part of me that doesn't really care. I'm going to watch all three.
Right, exactly. But no, I mean, I get the same is true of books. You know, I mean, if you have book one of a series, which is as itself totally unsatisfying as a book because it's not really conceived of as a separate book, but is just like a part of a story which breaks off in the middle, like a, you know, like a serial novel from the 19th century published in magazines or something like that. Well, that's not really very satisfying. You know, then I would say that's a blemish in that book. If you're going to have a series of sort of, you know, it should stand on its own. There should be some kind of reward to reading that book on its own.
And I suppose there's limits to that, right? Like, if you're writing an ongoing series, I mean, you know, it's just like, let's face it, reading The Return of the King without reading the first two, or reading
sure.
or even worse, reading one of George R. R. Martin's later novels without having read any of the earlier ones. I mean, the Harry Potter suffers from this increasingly as the series goes on.
Increasingly,
right? First couple of books have this really nice, tight arc, and then the later books is just,
So
there's limits to that, and even that, like, there's limits to how far you can take that criticism. But,
yeah, no, it's not that I would argue that you should be able to pick up book five in any series and read it satisfyingly as a book on its own. I wouldn't say that, but. But as far as having each book be enjoyable in itself, and having some level of satisfaction in it, I think it's one of the things that here I get into dangerous ground, because we move towards the later George R. R. Martin books that I haven't read yet. But the main criticisms that I've heard about book four and book five is that they increasingly get away from that level of satisfaction, that, like, you don't feel mm-hmm. like the story has begun and ended at all, like that there's and that there's a sense of progress in the overall thing. That's what I've heard from people who have read those, and I can, you know, that's what I think is a little bit more of a blemish.
Are we in even the same hemisphere as our schedule?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it, Dave.
We're good.
I'm keeping track.
We're good.
Believe
okay,
me.
All right.
We're good.
You will encounter the ire of Trish if
that's
if
right.
It goes over.
Trish is going to be our timekeeper. She's going to. In fact, I think we should get Trish a. Somebody should lift for us the sound effect of the whip crack from Where There's a Whip, There's a Way.
I was going to be nicer. I have a Tibetan singing bowl that makes a nice ring, and I was going to use that.
No, I think a whip crack is really what we need.
Is it a whip crack
you
as
know,
a warning?
Where there's a whip,
there's
okay, a well, way.
I might be able to do that, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I think we should do that. Anyway, the other theoretical issue I wanted to raise, because this is something I've been reflecting on further since my Tolkien professor episode, and I've decided this is a momentous occasion. I'm going to coin a word today. This is I've been thinking about this.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
No. We only get to coin one word a day, and I already did. Meta enjoyment.
Yeah. Well, that was
that
your
was
word.
Your
that was your word. I've got one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You can coin one too.
Yeah. I'm going to coin one too. Okay. And again, it relates to the general the thing that people have been saying, certainly and especially ever since the whole three film announcement was made back in 2012, that, you know, all of this stuff is just a money grab, or you know, they're doing this just to appeal to one thing or the other. And I talked about this in my earlier episode, and the main thing, just to do a very brief recap, that's where I was quoting C.S. Lewis's On Criticism. And, you know, to summarize that is simply C.S. Lewis pointing out that one of the things that critics do very often, which is a very, very sloppy habit to get into as a critic, is first noticing that there is some kind of blemish. You know, that there's something bad, there's something you don't like, there's something that you think is bad about a work of art. And instead of thinking about what makes it bad, and, you know, what you know, instead of actually stopping and really doing analysis of the work of art at that point, to try to point to in what its badness consists, to instead leap to making a fictional narrative about the author, and to making claims about what the author was or was not thinking or did not do. And, you know, in particular, the kinds of examples that C.S. Lewis uses in that essay, again, this is C.S. Lewis's essay on criticism, which you can find in his book, the collection of his essays called Of Other Worlds, if you're interested. What C.S. Lewis talks about is particularly when somebody says, oh, this was really rushed, or, or they'll say, you know, this seemed like a really half-hearted essay. And C.S. Lewis, you know, says, you know, I've heard people call this one essay in a collection that I wrote, you know, half-hearted and just filler, when in fact I know, as a point of historical fact, that was the one that I cared most about and that I was most invested in, and for me was the center of the entire collection. And then he pauses and says, now, I agree with people when they say that it is the worst of the pieces. Like, I agree with them that it is bad. You know, there are things about that essay that are not good. It does not work very well. I failed in the writing of it. But merely to say, to instead of saying, let's actually look at it and think about it and say what, you know, what is bad about it and what can we learn from that, to just dismiss it and to dismiss it with a fiction about the author that you're guessing at and haven't the faintest idea if you're right or not, is simply laziness. That is simply the avoidance of analysis. It's not analysis at all. And this keeps coming up for me again and again and again with responses to The Desolation of Smaug. Oh, this is just a money grab. Apart from the whole fact that almost every artist in the history of the world has worked for money, the larger point to me is, you're not, when you say that, you've stopped doing analysis at all. Now you're just you are writing fiction about what is going on in the mind and motivations of the artists, of the people involved. And you know what? You're guessing, and you might be wrong. And even if you're right, what do we learn? How does that help us in any way? To do that is to simply avoid it. So here's my word. We already have the word fan fiction. Right? Fan fiction is the imaginative investment in somebody else's created world, right? So if you're going to write a story which takes place in somebody else's creative world and deals with their character, you're going to imaginatively invest yourself in someone else's story and write your own story within that world, that's fan fiction. To create a fictional story about why an author did something, or what the author's motivation was, or what was going on in their author's head, that's crit fic. That's crit fiction. That's my new word. So one of my take home messages from today: beware crit fiction. Because the thing is, fan fiction, you know, people always and in very knee jerk fashion are very dismissive of fan fiction. And I would say, again, speaking as a medievalist, there is an enormously dignified pedigree for fan fiction. Some of the best works of literature in the Western canon could be classified as fan fiction. I don't even know what percentage of Shakespeare's works could be classified as fan fiction, if you define it in the way that I did. But again, that's fan fiction can be dreadful, but the actual intellectual and imaginative exercise of fan fiction I find respectable. In fact,
that's true. It originates in love.
Yeah. And actually contains artistic expression. I mean, it can be a vehicle for artistic expression. I mean, it can be a perfectly valid and interesting imaginative exercise to invest yourself in. And you could classify Virgil as fan fiction, for crying out loud. But crit fiction is utterly unrespectable. I find no justification for crit fiction under almost any circumstances, because just by its nature.
So what's our technical definition of crit fiction?
Okay, crit fiction is creating a fictional narrative about the author's process of writing or the author's motivations for writing. So when you cease to, when you first observe that a work is, you know, you dislike something, you disapprove of something, you think that there's something bad about a film or a book or something like that, and instead of doing analysis of it, you instead substitute for that analysis a fictional account of what you guess was probably going on in the mind of the author, or what motivated the author to write that bad thing.
And in this sense, author, you're talking about is Jackson.
Right, exactly.
And you're talking about Jackson, really, in this.
So in this, when yes.
For
in,
author, you mean Jackson.
Right, I mean the whoever the artist in question, because I think it happens all over the place. It happens right. Talking about films, it happens talking about fiction, it happens talking about art. So and the thing is, it, you know, when I say you are inventing a fiction, it's really subtle, because it's not like you have to tell a story. You can do critfic in a single word. Again, Lewis was giving examples of this. If you call something rushed, that's not analysis, that's critfic. You know, you're not actually doing analysis of the text. You are saying in that one word, you know, a fictional narrative of the process of the author's writing. Sure. So that's something that I think is always at the least sloppy. Now the thing is, and this is again something that C.S. Lewis was emphasizing in that essay. This is not only tremendously easy to do, it's tremendously difficult to avoid. His one of the things he was recognizing was that our critical vocabulary is just peppered with words which are fundamentally critfic words. And it's hard to avoid. And I know that I don't myself successfully avoid it at all times. I'm often guilty. But anyway, I do think, you know, so Finley asks, can't writing be rushed in and of itself? No. Writing can have a quality which might make you think the author was rushed when writing it. But again, in speaking of that particular example, and again, I'm quoting C.S. Lewis here because, again, this I don't want to take credit for thinking of this idea. This was C.S. Lewis's concept. I'm just giving it the name.
You came up with a catchy word.
Exactly. I came up with a catchy word. So therefore, C.S. Lewis and I are like on a level here. We've now co-created this thing. Because he thought of all the substance and I'm marketing it. But anyway, Finley, thinking about that, because basically his argument, again... thinking as a critic of criticisms of the books that he wrote, you know, someone would criticize a passage in the Chronicles of Narnia and say that it was rushed, and he would know that in fact he'd labored over it, that, you know, that had been one that he had spent days working on, and so to call it rushed is simply flatly inaccurate. Instead, he says, however, if you want to talk about, you know, the quality of the prose or the quality of the story, there probably is something wrong. There probably is something that doesn't work well in that passage. But don't just call it rushed, which is whether or not you're thinking about it explicitly, merely a guess about the composition process. Instead, do more analysis of that passage. What are its qualities that make you think the author rushed when writing it?
Right.
And that is a really productive, you know, when you make yourself pause and think about that, it's a really productive exercise, because you find, in fact, that so many of the terms that we use, so much of the criticisms we have and objections we have, are really intellectually sloppy, in fact, and it really presses us to think more carefully about this stuff. So anyway. Tyson says, it seems that I have come to despise crit fiction in all its forms as soon as I became old and wary enough to detect its presence. Yes. I think that that's
these
true.
These listeners are pretty amazing. You guys are amazing.
Yeah. Timothy Fisher
now,
was asking...
just let me ask you,
sure,
so another example would be, I think I have said this on record, and we're going to be talking about the action and violence as a theme later, so I don't want to get too far into it. But I mean, I've said, I think, a number of times when we've talked about these two movies, I brought up the thing about demographics, and I suppose that's a subset of money grab, I suppose, right? Where,
yes.
Where my conjecture is that Jackson may be trying to please a particular segment of the audience.
Yes.
That's also kind of critfic,
it is.
Isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yep. That is critfic. That absolutely is not. Now, again, that...
We're not banning it altogether, right? What we're saying is don't substitute it for thoughtful analysis.
Well, I think it gives me the opportunity. If I have that opinion, then it's up to me to defend it. And I think that's what you're saying, right? I mean, I need to go...
Yes and no.
Analysis.
Yes and no. What I would say is to say that, yes, that statement is a critfic statement is not to say that your observation is invalid. but right. rather to push it further and say, okay, I do not find it acceptable just to say he was trying to appeal to teenage boys in this scene. We don't know if he was trying to appeal to teenage boys in that scene. Right. Instead, tell me what it is about that scene that makes you think it was trying to appeal to teenage.
Right.
There is something there that you are observing. Dig further until you can really point to what it is that you are pointing. That's where I think the avoidance of critfic is so valuable because it really pushes us to do that. Now, Alex, two comments here from our listeners. Alexander was saying it's almost impossible to stop ourselves from committing both fan fiction and crit fiction. I agree. But that, I think, is exactly the line that we need to walk in a very self-conscious way. Because it's easy to start doing one or the other. When you're doing criticism, it's easy to start doing fan fiction. This is especially true of Tolkien. When people keep asking me speculative questions, which Tolkien never answered, you know, to be able to say, you know, what do I think about, you know, what do I think orc women are like? And I'm like, I have no idea. I don't think we ever met an orc woman. I have no data upon which to base this directly. However, we can speculate based on other things that he said, but when we're doing this, we're crossing a line into fan fiction. Now, even though we're doing analysis, we are now basically imaginatively investing ourselves in Tolkien's world and essentially writing our own little stories. Now, I don't find that totally invalid. I don't think that should never happen. I think, in fact, that kind of exercise, this is why I think that fan fiction is highly defensible as both a creative and even a critical activity, whereas crit fiction I don't find defensible in almost any manifestation, because crit fiction is the unwillingness to engage. Fan fiction usually is engaging, and when it's doing well, it's engaging, and often in very thoughtful ways with the text, and that I think is cool.
Sometimes
it's over again, right? Exactly. But anyhow, so anyway, we do have to be careful when we're doing analysis not to just blindly cross over into fan fiction. But again, what I think is important there is to be conscious when we're crossing the line, to know the difference. And to be explicit about the difference between when we're inventing and when we're interpreting.
Are you hearing that?
Which?
Can you hear that? The whip crack?
Oh, no, I can't. I couldn't.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to get my microphone close up to my speaker, unfortunately.
Okay.
I think what I probably ought to do is do a cut of the actual song. I'm only saying it's 20 after the hour, and I want to make sure if we want to end it at half.
Yeah,
we did
start about 10 minutes in, we've got about 15 minutes left. Let me.
And of course, in my case, I'm worried about my computer battery giving out. So
yeah.
Did you see David Rowe's poem that he tweeted at us?
No, I didn't.
I'll read it on the air. Don't be a hater or a puristic Jackson is a traitor baiter. Be a tolerator. Of course, David Rowe did the fantastic presentation on Proverbs at MythMoot.
Yeah, it was great to meet David at MythMoot this year. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, that's cool.
So what do we have on our schedule that we absolutely need to get to? Actually, we're doing fine. You left it, thankfully, wide open.
Yeah, James said, if Trisha's battery gives out, we can go off schedule all we want, right?
Yeah. We don't.
I mean, we can continue this conversation. I mean, partly I was just testing it because it was meant to sort of just be a, you know, let's be mindful of time. But I pretty much, when Corey and I talked about what we wanted to talk about today, I said, well, that could basically take up the whole episode.
Yeah, it really can. I wanted to address one more thing because I started to, and I don't want to leave him hanging. Timothy Fisher had asked two really interesting questions, and he said, is there good critfic that is motivated by love of the author or of the work? No. I would say no. There could be meta critfic, which is to say, this person is only doing critfiction because he really loves Tolkien's work. In which case, I'm doing crit fiction of the person who's doing crit fiction, which is kind of fun.
Talk about meta.
Exactly. That's totally meta, man. But again, the point is that crit fiction in this way, like the way that I'm defining crit fiction is it's something that I find always bad. That is, it is always lazy. It is by definition the avoidance of analysis of a text in order simply to speculate, guess, or make blanket assumptions or assertions about the author, about things you don't know. And frankly, even if you did know, they wouldn't matter. Again, to me, even if we knew for a fact, even if Peter Jackson said, yeah, really, actually, I don't care about anything in this film. The whole thing from beginning to end, I was only thinking in the most coldly mercenary way possible what was likely to make me the most money. And every single choice I made at every point was motivated by that question alone. Even if he said that, and we believed him, that wouldn't affect my interpretation of the film at all. That is to say, I wouldn't care. Because, in fact, I have heard authors say not exactly that, but say things like, oh, no, like, I don't think this, you know, my book is really, you know, about this idea. And I'll just look at what they say and I'll say, you know what, I think you're crazy. I think you don't understand your book at all. And, you know, we'll have to agree to disagree about your book. I often agree to disagree with authors about their book. There are a bunch of things I disagree with Tolkien about his book. Especially Tolkien's later thoughts.
Kate Neville just hit one, a crit fic that it just gets my blood boiling. The one about, oh, Tolkien hated women because there's so few female characters.
Yes.
That is just so inaccurate.
Yes.
That is like, no, anybody who says that has not even bothered to learn anything about Tolkien at all.
Yes.
I mean, that's just awful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kate.
I think it's fine. I think it's perfectly fair. Maybe this is where you see a fine distinction. It's perfectly fair to bemoan the lack of female characters.
Sure, absolutely.
In his writing, it's perfectly fair to read his works and come away with the sort of impression that these works seem anti-women or feel misogynistic to you as you read them. But it's when you jumped from that to Tolkien the person obviously hated women,
yes,
or dismissed them. That's when you stray into crit fic.
Right, exactly. And especially, again, the purest crit fic argument would be Tolkien didn't include any women in The Hobbit because he hates women.
Yeah.
Right. That's crit fic. Now,
yes.
Now, what Dave said earlier is not crit fic. It's like, gosh, you know, I noticed there's not very many female characters in Tolkien.
And this doesn't appeal to me as much because,
right,
I don't enjoy reading as much because there aren't, which is fine.
That's not
because
crit
now you're
fiction.
Making it about yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly. No.
Like
doing doing analysis is good, and you can come. You can, you know, by all means, let's make you know, do readings and have arguments about it, and that's fine. But again,
I think there could be positive crit fic too, couldn't there be? In other words, you could attribute.
Oh yes. Oh, absolutely.
You know,
yes.
Motivations to support that you like Jackson's movies, but it could be just as fictional as
absolutely
negative stuff.
Absolutely. No. That is clearly.
And you know,
yeah.
And it's not always the critics' faults in a sense. The creators themselves sometimes. Lead us down the garden path to doing this. When Philippa Boyens or Peter Jackson come and say, well, we added Toriel because we felt we needed more female characters and we wanted the film to appeal more to female viewers, then it's sort of, you know, like they're basically setting a trap for us, leading us in the direction of thinking about when we watch Toriel instead,
yeah,
of just enjoying Toriel as a character. We're thinking, well, this is the character they added because they said they needed to have more female characters.
Yes.
You know, like,
and can I tell you something?
So,
this is why,
yes,
reading the work of dead authors, and preferably long dead authors, I find so much nicer.
Yes.
I get really annoyed by living authors, actually, so many times. And often, you know, for instance. But, yeah, no, I mean, like, basically, authors can't help but draw attention to themselves and their own motivations. You know, when you hear an author talk about their own work and what they did, they're going to talk about what they were thinking. They're going to talk about what they want you to think about it. And that's okay. But yes, you're right, Dave. That lines us up to be doing, both prompts us to think in those terms. And even frankly, if somebody says, we introduce the character of Toriel, you know, if when Boyan says we introduce the character of Toriel because we wanted there to be more female characters and we wanted to increase the female presence. Okay, but you know what? That shouldn't actually influence my interpretation of Toriel at all. I should still be looking at the work of art on its own ground and say, you know, let us look about the character of Toriel and what was actually accomplished, not intended, but accomplished in the depiction of the character of Toriel. Because, see, that's the problem with authors. When they tell us what they meant, they might have meant it. But the question is, did they do it? You know, did they succeed in doing it? And again, this gets back to another C.S. Lewis distinction, the very important distinction between the meaning of the story and the intention of the author. Sometimes the author, right. You know, sometimes those two things are very different. You can, and that can mean a complete failure. You know, like somebody who says, you wrote, you know, somebody says, oh, I thought your book was really funny. And the author's like, actually, I didn't intend it to be funny at all. I was completely serious all the way through. You know, that's a failure. That author failed. That doesn't necessarily mean the result was bad. You know, it might be a perfectly good comic work, but the author didn't realize it was comical. And so therefore they failed to achieve their vision. Their intention was not manifested in the work. Now that's a really crude example. But again, to me, it's kind of interesting to hear from the author, what were they thinking about? What did they intend? What were the most important things to them? What kind of things were motivated them? But at the end of the day, that's not the same thing as actually looking at the work.
Faye, I think her last name is Rivar or Ravar, mm-hmm. pointed out something that both Dave and I agreed with violently. She asked, does a biological interpretation of Tolkien's work fall under critic? Is this
biographical,
similar to the allegorical,
yes.
or allegorical reading that he detested so much? And you've talked about this at length in a number of your lectures about how knowing what he went through in the war, for example, may be interesting, but it doesn't necessarily change how you read his book.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, that kind of thing. It's like, you know, people saying, oh, it was his first world war is, you know, transferred to the dead marshes. Let's be careful about
right.
that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. 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 I agree. Now, one way in which I would say that some of those biographical interpretations differ from what I am calling critfic is that they are rather, sometimes it's not a question of people making guesses or assumptions about what was going on in Tolkien's life and using those as, you know, sort of reasons or explanations of what's in the text, but the other way around. That is, people who read the text in order to draw conclusions about Tolkien's life. And that's not exactly the same phenomenon. Tolkien hated that, mostly because, again, he felt like any reading of a story which tosses the story aside and is really only interested in the psychology of the author is just, like, totally missing the point of stories.
So I'm completely screwed with my master's thesis, right? About Galadriel and Tolkien's thing. I mean, that's totally what I'm doing in my master's thesis. But Corey has been actually coaching me on how to walk the fine line on that.
It's a fine line. It can be done. I mean, it's not about
walking the fine line. It's not about avoiding it altogether.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it is. It is. Noam had a really good point. He said, I would say that critfic can be developed into a fictional narrative all of its own. Yes, Noam, and in a couple of, in a few instances, that has happened. Think about, for instance, and Dave will probably be able to think of, I'm blanking on examples, but of films that have depicted the story of an artist's work, right? You know, say a film which gives us the story of an artist or an author working on a book or a piece of art. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you could say that whole story is critfic taken into a narrative, right? Developed into a narrative. And that actually, maybe that's the one way in which, like, basically if you take critfic far enough, if you actually develop a narrative which can itself interact with the work of art in some interesting ways, you know, maybe there could be, you know, a place for that kind of thing. It's if it's sufficiently kind of developed. But
okay, now I really am cracking the whip, because we do have some announcements to make, so we need to wrap this puppy up.
Yep, we do. Okay.
A lot of good food for thought today. I mean, I think this is going to be great to then... Our next episode will be getting into more details of Desolation of Smaug and talking about the Riddles in the Dark game and stuff. But I think this is a great foundation.
All those things that we spent today talking about how you shouldn't do them, next episode we'll be doing them.
We'll be doing them.
I'm broadcasting, but is it very important?
So all this, highfalutin philosophical stuff. Yeah, all this highfalutin philosophical stuff is great. Next week, you know, what Peter Jackson was thinking when
exactly.
So anybody who takes notes today can call us on it, you know, next time when we start to give our own opinions about the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Rybar. Okay, Rybar. Thank you, Faye. That's it. Okay.
Alden Foster was asking about Shadowlands as an example of what I was talking about. Sort of. Not so much in that the C.S. Lewis film Shadowlands is not so much about the creative process of C.S. Lewis's writings as it is about his life and his marriage. But in that direction. Anyway, okay. So we're going to talk about upcoming things, right, Trish? Is that where we're at?
Yes, we're to the closing and announcement section.
Closing and announcement sections of our detailed script.
Minutes.
Exactly, right. Okay. So just to do some quick, just to let you guys know stuff that's coming up and things that are going on. For those of you who didn't see or weren't involved, we started this past week on Tuesday, the Unfinished Tales class, the newest Mythgard Academy class. These are free and open classes. They are book discussions that are sort of inspired by the Silmarillion seminar, that kind of let's come together as a group and read a book and sort of discuss it through a chapter, a couple chapters at a time, week by week. That's what the Mythgard Academy does, and those classes.
And it was to a packed house.
Packed
for the first
house.
One.
Yeah,
oh my God,
We had 100 people, and we had to set up an overflow room. Ed Powell, who is the Saruman the White of the Mythgard Academy Council, used his Palantir to set up a simulcast, on the webpage as a kind of overflow room for people who couldn't make it into the Netmood. It was really cool.
It's just so scary to call Ed Saruman the White. I just... You know, I said, does that mean we shouldn't trust you?
Well, that's been the... Ed and I have been joking about that from the beginning. You know, in my very first email announcement, I was like, I chose Ed for this job because he has a mind of metal and wheels. I think he's perfect. But the thing is...
He's still white.
He is still white. Anyway, so that was really fun. We had a great first response to Unfinished Tales. We did an overview of the Unfinished Tales, and we talked about Tuor. We're going to start the Turin Bar still. We're going to do 2 weeks on the Narni Hin Hurin. Brace yourselves, make sure you take your medications before we do our discussion of Turin, because,
Prozac.
Yeah, exactly. If you're on antidepressants, make sure you're up to date, because I'm telling you, the Turin story gets to you if anyway, so, yeah, and I have to be careful, because seriously, like, one time when I was teaching this story, I reread it, like, two or three times in one week when I was teaching and I was at the end, I was like seriously emotionally messed up. Like, I couldn't handle it.
I've been avoiding reading Children of Hurin because I understand it gets even worse in the full book version.
It does, yeah. And basically, the Unfinished Tales version is very similar. The published Children of Hurin is based very largely on the Unfinished Tales one.
Okay.
Which we'll talk about on Tuesday.
This, I can do it. Okay.
This coming Tuesday evening, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to be doing the first half all the way until Turin arrives in Brethil. So all the way through the fall of Nargothrond, we're doing in Tuesday's class. So for those of you who can join us, go to www.mythgard.org/academy, and you will find the Unfinished Tales webpage. The links to our class sessions are there. And remember...
And thankfully, the links to the audio and video as well.
Yes, the audio, which are not up yet. We've had a little delay for the first one because we're still getting things in place. But that should be just about done. And I should be able to get that stuff up by tomorrow at the latest. So for those of you who are waiting for the recordings, my apologies on the slight delay this time. They'll go up quicker in the future.
By the way, we're following that same model with the Riddles in the Dark page,
Yes, the recordings of this will also be available on the web, right. the Riddles in the Dark webpage, yes.
And the live links, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We've posted the schedule ahead of time.
Yeah.
And we have the live links. Exactly. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, good. And the one other thing...
now so you get reminders.
Exactly.
Sorry.
The one other thing that's going on this coming week, this Monday, starts our next semester in our Mythgard Institute classes. So for those of you who might be interested in going a little bit deeper, if you have, you know, if your reading of Tolkien has led you to, as it has so many people, a desire to actually dig in and study fantasy literature and Tolkien and medieval literature and all those other things that Tolkien studied, and was so devoted to. If you would like to learn more about these things yourself and really dig in and immerse yourselves in these things, we have the Mythgard Institute program, the master's degree program, which you can either audit classes just to sit in on them and get the advantage of taking some of these classes with really world-class scholars. The new class we're offering, I'm doing a class on Chaucer this semester, so if you're interested in learning how to read Chaucer, in really experiencing one of the greatest medieval authors, Chaucer is totally my second favorite author in the world, second to Tolkien. I really love it. So if you're interested in actually getting into some stuff, Michael is asking me what's the best text for the Middle English of the Tales. The Riverside Chaucer is the default. There are a couple other editions of the Canterbury Tales.
Also makes a great paperweight or doorstop.
Yeah, it's large. And for many years it's been hard to get hold of the paperback version. But anyway,
Amazon will also rent it, by the way. I noticed at least Amazon US, when I went up to get it, I got a used version of it, but they'll also rent the book.
Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Sort of taking textbook return to the next level.
Yes, right.
But anyway, so I'm teaching a Chaucer class. Dr. Amy Sturgis, who has been teaching with us for a while now, she is fantastic. She is her specialty is the history of ideas. So what she has been doing individual semester classes on the whole history and development of modern subgenres. So she did a 2-semester class on the development of the science fiction genre from the 19th century forward. She has done a class on dystopian literature. She's done a class on mystery literature. This semester, she's doing one on Gothic literature, going back to 18th century Gothic novels and looking at the Gothic tradition moving forward. That class should be really cool. And then our third class is a class on Celtic mythology and modern children's fantasy. So looking at, we'll spend the first half of the semester reading Celtic mythology, and then looking at the ways in which that mythology has been integrated into modern fantasy literature, especially modern fantasy literature for kids. It's a really cool class. And Dimitra Femi, this is her first semester teaching with us at Mythgard. She is just world-class. She is one of the top Tolkien scholars in the world, and just a fantastic teacher. So we are delighted to have her joining us this semester.
I want to give a plug as a Mythgard student here to the folks, you know, because we have so many people now with the Unfinished, with the Mythgard Academy and with Riddles in the Dark really loving, you know, the engagement. Corey engages folks. We get to engage with one another. And there's been all this furor about chat rooms and all this stuff. Let me just say, with the Mythgard courses, whether you do it as an auditor, which is, I think, one of the best deals in the planet, or as an actual program participant, it allows you access to the discussion board for the course and also to the chat room if you want to be in a chat room during the lecture. But the discussion board, I got to tell you, folks who are Mythgard students just blow me away. You know, you can do have the lecture with your professor, and then the discussion board picks up the topics, and folks are just so learned and so insightful and so willing to debate on the discussion boards, that if you like that kind of thing, then definitely that's something you don't really get with the free academy courses other than what we do on like Facebook and whatnot. But it's definitely something you get even if you're just doing it as an auditor with the Mythgard courses. And Corey did not pay me to say this.
Yeah. No, it has been, from the beginning, so rewarding and so delightful, the group of people who have been involved as Mythgard students. And, you know, and I will say that the way in which that has been working out, the number of, there has been a very large number of Mythgard students who, keep in mind, are people who have not been by any means professional academics, but who have really come back and immersed themselves in this and who are now presenting papers at scholarly conferences and even getting published. It's been really cool.
I know, no, people would not know that I'm a high-powered senior corporate geek. That's what I've always been, you know, and I mean, Mythgard's turned me into this, you know, kind of scholar.
Yeah,
I'm kind of a scholar.
How many papers have you given at conferences now, Trish?
Like three or four now,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
yeah.
Trish is now like a regular in the Tolkien conference circuit now.
Yeah.
You
know,
I'm prepping up my next MythCon proposal.
Yeah.
How many of those papers have you sent to me to read?
Actually, today I was thinking maybe I should give you the whole conference experience, Dave, and I'll record them and send them to you.
Yeah, I'll listen to them, too.
And my one at MythCon actually had visuals to go with it. I had this whole Elrond family tree thing with all these great visuals.
Excellent.
That I'm trying to figure out how to send to you.
I was a big fan of the talks at MythMoot that combined, that skillfully used PowerPoints and visuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're definitely, you can do PowerPoints poorly,
yes.
But if you do them well, it's certainly more engaging than just listening to someone read their paper. There's part of me that's like, I just, you know, just give me the, I'll just read it, give it to me.
Right.
Because I have to admit that, you know, Verlyn Flieger has always, she has attended every one of my talks, and I have to admit that I find that daunting. Because she has a poker face, you know what I mean?
Yes,
it's like,
she does.
I just don't. I don't know. Is this working? Is this not working? And of course, if I ask her after, she's such a nice person, she'll always say, oh, you were fine.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah. Verlyn Flieger has an awesome game face. You know, when she's there in session and she's like listening and processing what you're saying, she's totally got her game face on. And I absolutely know what you mean.
Oh, it's distracting. And she sits up close to the front. And you're like, oh my God, I'm not, you know, whoa. You know, it's just, when I was doing Elrond's Family Tree, I kept like stealing a look over at her and I got nothing.
Right. Yep. Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So when can we get some of these? We need to get some of these people on here, Corey.
On Riddles in the Dark?
Yeah.
Well, it would be fun. It's something I've been thinking about, you know, that maybe we could try to get some more guests.
Even if not on Riddles in the Dark,
Tolkien Chats,
Tolkien,
yeah.
Chat or something.
Yep.
I want to hear what Dimitra Femi thinks of the films, and
yeah.
I don't even know if Verlyn Flieger even bothered to go watch them.
I think Verlyn has more going on in her dislike of the movies than just the movies themselves. She's very loyal to the Tolkien family, and yeah. I think,
yes.
You know, she's it's a kind of a sore subject for her. I mean, I've kind of touched on it a couple times with her, and she gives me a funny response, but I think there's some stuff going on there.
Yes, I think so,
too. Amy Sturgis, I'm sure, has some interesting thoughts, and she's a dynamic podcasting personality.
Yeah. No, it's you know, a couple people, you know, as we're starting our last season of Riddles in the Dark, you know, there have been a couple people who have been saying, oh, man, like, this is the last season. That means it's going to end. What are we going to do after that? And my main answer...
It's like starting on the last chapter of a book.
Exactly.
I know. Something else will come up.
And anyway, the other thing that I would like to do is more Tolkien chats. I would love to do a more systematic series of talks with other scholars, talks with fans, talks with, you know, just different people who are interested in Tolkien. You know, it'd be fun to get in people from lots of different perspectives and interests and backgrounds to talk about Tolkien and stuff. So that I suspect are going to do a little bit more than that. So
there'll be more cool stuff after this ends. So
yeah.
Okay, time to Godspeed us, Corey.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.